Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this August the 13th on the West Coast. That's also known as Friday the 13th. And now August the 14th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to thank all those who tuned in to the show last night on Wind Talkers Radio Network. Heard we had some huge numbers of new listeners, and we appreciate your support and your kind words. Wow, where do we go? First of all, I got to tell you, some of the most astounding, incredible radio, yet it's very, very credible at the same time. On Dr. A. Truat's The Story Behind the Story this evening, if you don't listen to that show or you're unable to, it is available in the Micro Effect Archives. However, Dr. Ott will be with us next Monday, and I'm sure he's going to want to discuss some of what came forth from his guest, Mr. Clay Douglas, today. It was very, very interesting and very eye-opening. Tonight's guest is our regular Friday night guest. He's affectionately called our resident science advisor. He is a scientist, a prolific inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and my co-host as well, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, how are you this evening? Hello, Jim. For some reason, Don, I'm not hearing Jim.
Well, I can hear you.
Oh, now I can hear you. Okay. I think maybe your volume control may have been turned down. So, on my end. Thank you, Don. I can hear Jim. How are you?
I'm well, Don. How are you?
Good. Good. We've been talking about various scientific topics in regard to power production and energy and the misnomer of what energy is or what power is about or the end result work, some activity that's performed as a result of the power being able to be introduced into a device that can use it to produce a specific task. And I got a few emails from some people over the past few weeks, actually, but I started getting enough to consider asking the question and answering the question, which science doesn't seem to want to do, according to some of the people that I've heard from in that regard, and that's, what is electricity? And I think we could talk about what it is, where it comes from, how it evolved into what it is today, and how can we be using it more efficiently, making it more easily available to the average person? That's quite a mouthful, and we did decide that we were going to talk about that, so you had a chance to prepare, but I didn't pose these questions to you, and I'm not in any way implying you can't answer them, but I think we'd have an interesting show tonight to talk about this because the aspect of energy is on everybody's mind with what's going on around the world with all of these imploding oil wells. Isn't it interesting how this all happens at the same time? It's like hurricanes and earthquakes and volcanoes and tornadoes. They come in swarms. Is this the reality now that we're facing? So electricity always has seemed to be a more cost-effective source of power for us, and at the same time, it should be much cheaper. In fact, it shouldn't cost anything because it exists everywhere. So if you would, and if it doesn't in some places, please let me know, you know. But if you would tackle that topic tonight, I think it'd be very interesting for our listeners.
Well, I'll do my best. After all, I certainly don't pretend to know everything about it, even though I've worked with it most of my life. But we can certainly present a couple of reasonable explanations, some theories, and see where it leads us.
That sounds so, reasonable.
First of all, I'm sorry, Don, what did you say?
Oh, I just said that sounds reasonable. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
No problem. First of all, I guess the right thing to do would be to go back to the real expert. Certainly isn't me, our dear friend Nikola Tesla. And actually, he wrote quite a bit about what he thought the nature of electricity was. And the interesting thing is that he likens it unto a fluid in its behavior, an incompressible fluid, as a matter of fact. And that's got a certain amount of validity to it because, in a large measure, it does behave that way. It certainly has the capability of surging through conductors and being compressed in a certain sense, just like a fluid, like a hydraulic fluid would be, entering a reservoir, things of that sort. So in that regard, mathematically, I suppose you could liken it unto a fluid. The real question, of course, is what does this fluid consist of? And here's where I think it gets kind of interesting. If you consider the way in which it's regarded in most textbooks, the explanation that's given is that it's actually a series of electrons which are moving through a crystal lattice of the metal, like copper or silver, and they kind of bump their way along by hopping from atom to atom and move as a disturbance through the metallic structure.
Well, if I can interject something there, then am I to conclude that, therefore, on the basis of that definition, that lightning, natural lightning that we see in the skies preceding or during a storm, is not real electricity?
No, I wasn't. I wouldn't say that.
You get the meaning. I just want to make that distinction that definition says that it has to move through a wire.
No, it says that it's a series of electrons or charges moving through a wire. But don't forget, in a gaseous medium like the atmosphere, you also have all kinds of charges flying around. They're basically referred to as ions. And it's pretty well defined now that, you know, there is an ionic path that a lightning strike will follow.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that regard, it's not so far off. But still, in my opinion, that doesn't bring us to an answer.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. In other words, if the definition of electricity is electrons moving in a particular path, and I knew that word electron would come up, which really doesn't explain it unless you understand electrons and atoms and neutrons, but then you introduced another element and another environment where the word electron didn't exist. So this is what I'm trying to get to in you defining the meaning. That's all I'm clarifying here. I'm not saying you're not doing it or not doing it correctly. I'm just thinking outside the box. We're looking for the essence of what that answer is.
Well, give me a chance to get to it.
Okay, I'll be quiet. All right.
One of the things that Tesla talks about, which is pretty amazing, and has a great deal to do with the answering of that question, also propagates from his concept of electricity being a fluid. So let me backtrack and give you some insights as to how that type of reasoning holds up.
Okay.
First of all, as you probably know, Tesla's area of expertise was high voltage and high frequency. And one of the things that he discovered, which is really pretty interesting, is the nature of electrical impulse. Now, impulse in physics is defined as force times time. And if you take the trouble to do dimensional analysis of that, you'll find out that it has the same dimensions as momentum does. And so what's interesting about looking at it that way is that if electricity were, in fact, the movement of electrons or some other charged particle, then the following experiment that I'm going to relate casts a really, really interesting perspective on that definition. One of the things that Tesla did with electrical impulse was that he brought the voltage to an amazingly high value, somewhere in the millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of volts. And then he slowly brought the frequency up higher and higher and higher until he reached a very interesting point. And that point was that he could no longer detect current flow in the wire, and yet there was all the effects of a current flowing. In other words, the instrumentation couldn't follow it any longer at these very high frequencies. But the effects were there in the sense that he was accomplishing some form of work with something. And after a great deal of experimentation along these lines, what he concluded was the following. There are two aspects to the phenomenon of electricity. If you want to assume that a movement of charged particles in particular, it forms the basis of this mysterious agent, then you're forced to admit that something happens when the frequency gets to and the voltage both get to a very high level, because you can no longer detect the same effects as before, and yet something interesting is still happening. And the way he explains it is like this. He said, if you have take a tennis ball and soak it in water so the fur is very wet. Now, if you then serve that tennis ball by hitting it with a racket, you'll notice that the ball takes off and the water stays behind. Maybe not all of it, but most of it. And the result, that particular result, is due to the fact that the mass of the ball has a great deal more inertia because the force of the racket was delivered to the ball itself and not to the water upon the ball. And so the ball takes off and essentially leaves the majority of the moisture behind. And where he hypothesized was, this is something very similar that happens when you have these very high frequencies and high voltages operating in an electric circuit. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you reach a point where the alternations of a voltage or a potential are so fast that even though you're considering the mass of a, let's say it's a single electron for the sake of the explanation, which I don't remember the weight of, but it's some enormously small number, you know, like 2.5 times 10 to the minus 23rd grams or something like that. It's a very small amount of mass. But anyway, the effect is that you reach a point where the forces are so huge, and yet the time period is so small that the inertia of the electron's mass prevents it from moving. In other words, the normal idea, and you can try this with, you know, with something large, and you get the idea of it. For instance, if you had a bowling ball, if you give it a shove from the left and then you give it a shove from the right, first it'll move in the direction of the applied force, and then when you shove it in the other direction, it'll move the other way. But if you could shove hard enough and fast enough and alternate between the left hand and the right hand shove back and forth, you would eventually reach a point where the mass of the ball prevented you from moving the ball because the time period was so small that you that the inertia of the ball wouldn't be able to respond with a normal acceleration. The result would be the ball would sit there and vibrate. So, interesting enough, when you do this with a hypothetical particle like an electron, what happens is the same thing. It sits there and vibrates. It can't move. But what does move is the charge gets torn off the electron, just like the water gets removed from the wet tennis ball. Mm-hmm. And you eventually reach a point where you are only dealing with pure charge and not charge associated with mass. Now, you start talking about electrons and protons and all these various charged particles, and you'll find that in the physics books they're given a charge-to-mass ratio because there's a certain measurable amount of charge which is being carried by a certain measurable amount of mass. And nobody, to my knowledge, except a very few people, have considered what happens if the charge is literally removed from the mass. And now this brings us to a very interesting place, because another person who I respect very highly talked a great deal in his lifetime about massless charge, and that was Wilhelm Reich. Reich's orgone, which is this very peculiar energy associated with living entities, he essentially defined as being a form of charge devoid of mass. Now, the interesting thing about that is that if you think about it, it would have very different properties than normal electricity. And yet, normal electricity, as we know it, wouldn't be able to function without it. But it could function without electricity. And so now we get into that area, that really mysterious gray area of, you know, what do you have when you have accumulations of this massless charge?
Okay, before you go into that, Jim, can I ask you a question or two?
Sure.
In listening to you describe the person hitting the wet tennis ball with a racket or causing one side of a bowling ball to be struck to cause it to move in a particular amount or a particular direction at a certain rate of speed, the moment of impact would be the velocity at that point, would it not?
Well, the moment of impact would determine the resulting velocity, but it wouldn't be the velocity itself, because what you're talking about there is really the transfer of momentum from whatever is striking the ball, you know, to the ball itself.
And well, the reason I use that example, if I were to equate what you're saying into another modality that I can visualize in a couple of different ways, like music, if I take my finger and I place it on a piano key and slowly press down on the key enough to vibrate the string, cause the hammer to strike the string and produce a tone while I'm holding my finger down, the slower I do it, the softer the tone, and therefore the slower the velocity. When I take my finger and strike it rapidly, I transfer that energy much faster, and the volume is much louder. So we could say that the velocity has an impact on the amplitude of the wave. So I would think in terms of electricity, if what you're saying is true, then that would be sort of a way of explaining it. I understand that your conceptualization of electricity isn't just one little short burst. So I'm comparing it to sound in that a specific velocity will produce a specific amount of amplitude in the wave, which in music is volume. In electricity, it would be, what, amps or volts?
You're getting into an area where you really got to start adhering to definitions.
Okay, we'll hold that for a second then. I have one other thought that I saw when you were describing this process that Tesla was researching, and you mentioned going up to maybe even hundreds of millions of volts. Is it possible that the electrons flowing through, which we're defining as the electricity from point A to point B through the wire, if you speed that up enough, in other words, if you apply enough velocity to that stream of electrons, is it possible that it's no longer traceable in the wire because it moves into a different dimension or a different space and actually is not in the wire anymore, but still able to travel from point A to point B?
Okay. You're opening up a whole host of interesting points, but we're going to have to take them one by one, simply because I don't know who's listening or how much they know about this stuff. But basically, the idea of an electrical impulse is usually defined as a force of an electrical nature being applied to something that moves as a result of that. That force is actually not voltage. It is actually electromotive force, or EMF.
Okay.
Now, what happens is you get a lot of things happening when you make that application, particularly if the force is alternating in direction. In other words, it's first applied from the left, then it's applied from the right. Okay. There are several things that happen. First of all, the one that we were addressing is that some kind of particle or fluid or something in the conductor responds to this force. The velocity of the actual charge carriers has been measured many, many times, and it's surprisingly low. As a matter of fact, it's a very low velocity. It's referred to as a drift velocity. But then there is a secondary phenomenon known as the phase velocity. And the phase velocity is a lot faster than the drift velocity. But now you get to the point where Maxwell made his contribution. And that is that while this stuff is shuffling around in the wires, attempting to keep up with this force, simultaneously, you have an electric field which is created throughout the length of that conductor in whatever direction the force is operating. And you also have a magnetic field which is created around the wire.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be demonstrated, and has been demonstrated, that the so-called energy movement associated with the traveling of electricity actually can be looked upon as happening outside the wire, only conducted by the two force fields involved. So according to Maxwell, he disregarded whatever was going on inside the wire, concentrated on the fact that there are electric and magnetic fields, which can be described as the only agency involved. Then you can look at the other phenomenon wherein you have a movement of something within the wire, which is also measurable. And then you have the third situation that Tesla talked about, where you reach this point at which nothing is moving at all except this mysterious fluid, which he called charge-free, you know, some charge-free, in other words, mass-free of, charge-free of mass. I'm getting my terms twisted. So, as you can see, it very quickly becomes a complicated issue. Now, interestingly enough, Maxwell went ahead and developed his mathematical theory for the transfer of electrical energy from point A to point B before a lot of very fundamental discoveries were made. As a matter of fact, he hypothesized early on that you would have to have one of two different ways of describing this electrical phenomenon. Either there were some type of particles involved within the wire, or all the energy would be carried by the electric and magnetic fields. Now, a series of experiments were done early on to determine if any physical characteristics associated with gross particles seemed to be involved. And they couldn't find any results in that direction. So Maxwell went ahead on the assumption that there was no such phenomenon as true charge carriers, and he developed his famous equations based solely on the fact that electromagnetic and electrostatic fields carried all the energy. However, what's really interesting is two other physicists several years later came back and found the electromechanical aspects that Maxwell couldn't identify. And believe it or not, those two guys were Einstein, and I mean the Einstein, and de Haas. Now, what they did was they built machinery to try and measure various aspects of the movement of current, which would have to exist if current had, in fact, a mass associated with its motion. And they eventually were able to refine the instrumentation and the testing to the point where they did, in fact, discover that quantity. But nobody ever went back and rectified the original Maxwellian equations to include the Einsteinian and de Haas discovery, which seems to imply that there is at least more than one agency involved in the transport of this power associated with electricity. And so, you know, that brings us up to the more modern way of looking at things, which has pretty much been focused on the Maxwell point of view, so much so that when they reach certain frequencies, and it's like up in the megahertz range, they don't really consider true currents, you know, flowing in the normal way anymore. They start to look at the distribution of charge densities with respect to conductor geometries, and this leads to the idea of a waveguide, where you have essentially a square or a round pipe that's carrying these electrostatic and electromagnetic fields. And this is most readily seen, for instance, in radar, where if you actually look at the output of a magnetron or a klystron, for instance, the signal is actually carried to the antenna by a pipe. So the reason I bring that up is because in making that transition from solid conductors into waveguides for the sake of accommodating the Maxwellian field concept, what has happened is that Tesla's concepts were essentially discarded, because the things he was describing were only happening within solid conductors. And when you reach the frequencies he was talking about and some very high potentials, we no longer stay with solid conductors, but we move into this area of waveguides and microwave transmission, which is a whole different ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see, it gets complicated kind of quickly.
Yeah, I hope you don't think the two questions that I posed were inappropriate in regard to how you're laying this out. It just seemed like the right time to ask it before we left the wire, you know, so to speak.
No, I don't think they were inappropriate. It's just that sometimes questions that sound simplistic necessitate answers which are not so simple to understand, and then that leads you to the necessity for a very specific construct in trying to supply the information associated with the answer, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. You know, I liken this, let's say metaphorically, to an ocean that has currents flowing through it, and the ocean remains an ocean even though the currents are flowing through it. You know, I'm trying to get at this overall reality of how the electrons and the energy is gathered through nature to be identifiable as electricity, if you get, you know, to become concentrated. So,
well, okay, this brings us back, in my opinion, and now we're not talking about anything in a textbook, we're just talking about my opinion. This brings us back to where we were a couple of months ago when we were talking about this whole concept of the vortex.
Yes.
You know, when we were talking about the vortex, and we mentioned that in ancient times the vortex was described as a whirlpool, you might say, that was being produced within a substance known as vortexia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that all of these people are talking about the same stuff. It's just that down through the ages, the names of things change because you have different philosophies, you have different civilizations, you have different concepts. But nature remains the same regardless of what you call it.
Yes.
And I think that this vortexia, for instance, is probably the same thing as the ether. It's probably the same thing as Reich's orgone. It's probably the same thing as Tesla's massless charge. The answer to your question is that there's something that fills the void of space, which to us looks like it's empty, but it really contains something. And apparently that has the property of becoming, either turning into mass or becoming associated with mass in some way on a nuclear or atomic level. And therefore, when we make use of the disturbance of various particles, whether they be gas molecules, you know, confined to a glass tube, like you have in a neon sign or in a particle accelerator, or whether you have some kind of charge disturbance that's happening inside a physical electrical cable consisting of strands of copper surrounded by an insulator, or whether you have a waveguide, the same ingredient is being made use of in different ways. And so, similar to what you were talking about with music, just like you have different octaves of music and different ways in which it manifests itself, it's always the vibration of something, and usually air in the case of sound, that's involved. But the way in which it is vibrated and the pitch and the amplitude of those vibrations are perceived as being different kinds and qualities of sound. And the same thing is true with the production of electricity. I think the same agent is involved in all these various manifestations, but it manifests in different ways. And it has different characteristics as you change things like frequency and voltage and whatever is providing the channel for the current to move in.
Okay. Maybe this question isn't even appropriate, but I'm going to ask it anyway. These particles that are flowing through this grid, would you describe them as electromagnetic in nature or something else?
Well, I mean,
in other words, before it becomes electricity, what we know as a current.
Well, the thing that we know as current is a disturbance in the equilibrium of the crystalline structure itself that composes the metals that are involved.
Okay.
I mean, electricity is a lot more than that, though, because let me tell you something. The our technology today concentrates on a form of this electricity which flows through a conductor.
Yes.
Okay, we're all familiar with that. I mean, you got wires in your home, you got extension cords, you got all kinds of stuff which imply that there's something moving through this flexible channel that is covered by an insulating material, and if you bite through it or strip the insulation away, you can get walloped. But that's not the only kind of electricity, and it's worthy of note that there is an opposite kind of electricity which only flows through insulators and will go out of its way to avoid any type of conductors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the electricity that manifests itself in the kind of circuits that Tesla was talking about. But actually, it also appears in the more casual electric circuits as well. It's just that people don't realize it. Now, what I'm referring to is known as dielectricity, and it is what flows through a condenser, for instance, where you have two metal plates separated by an insulating medium, and it's pretty obvious that nothing flows through that insulator. If you take a conductivity meter, for instance, and put it across the two plates, it will show that there's no connection between those two plates. And yet, if we apply an alternating current to that same device, you'll get a current flow with little or no difficulty. And so the question is, well, what's happening? Well, in the insulating portion of that condenser or capacitor, if you prefer that term, you actually have this dielectric movement going on in the insulator. And the current that allows the disturbance on one set of plates to be transferred to the other set of plates without having a direct connection is this dielectricity, and in the textbooks it's referred to as a displacement current. But it's not really that simple. It gets a lot more involved. For instance, in Tesla's work, where he had these big coils that he was using, he had manifestations in those coils of both normal electricity and dielectricity. And the interesting thing about it is the normal electricity is associated with the transverse wave functions, which are primarily magnetic. And the longitudinal wave component is associated with the dielectric aspects of this current movement. And the interesting thing is that the dielectric movement of that type of current actually travels between the spaces in the windings, while the electricity part of it that we know or are more familiar with is actually traveling in the conductor itself. So the interesting thing is that it's very easy for people to say, oh, there's no such thing as an electrical longitudinal wave. But, of course, in nature it makes no distinction. I mean, sound waves are actually longitudinal waves. Why can't there be a longitudinal wave in another medium?
Yes.
Well, the fact is that at 60 cycles, which is the basic frequency that we normally use, 50 or 60 cycles, to move electricity for our convenience, the dielectric component associated with a current flow at 60 cycles and, let's say, a nominal voltage of 120 volts, is so minuscule that you wouldn't even be able to measure it. But if you had the same phenomenon geared up in such a way to maximize the dielectric component instead of keeping it as minimum, now the other wave aspects and all these other things that Tesla talked about suddenly become apparent. And so, you know, rather than condemn the man's work, I could never understand why people with the wherewithal and the brain power didn't try to recreate what he claimed he had accomplished, instead of just taking the easy way out and saying, well, the guy was getting senile and there's no such thing as a longitudinal wave. You know, these are non-scientific ways of dealing with this concept, and it demonstrates unequivocally how prejudicial science can really be.
Yeah, that was the nature of the topic, actually, is the fact that several people that I've been in communication with feel that no one in science has ever explained the nature of electricity, the true nature. And I said, well, let's give Jim Murray a shot. He seems to be willing to answer it in a very multidimensional way. So I'm glad I brought this topic to the show tonight. I didn't mean to get you off. I was going to say I didn't mean to get you off track because I know that you were following sort of a progression of ideas and concepts. So I want to allow you to return back to that. If it,
well, the
your
problem
intention.
Is that, to be honest with you, you reach a certain point where some of this stuff is pretty hard to talk about. I mean, if you're in a room where you had a meeting of PhDs that were discussing this type of stuff, you'd find out that the language that's being used is divided between scientific English and a set of mathematical equations. You reach a point where you wind up writing an equation on the board and then taking a derivative or the double derivative or an integral or something of that sort. And what you're doing on the board represents, in fact, the larger portion of what you're saying with your mouth. And, mm-hmm. and so, you know, the reason for that is that those people that deal with that stuff every day have common imagery or symbol sets in their minds, and the English is only directing them to focus on certain concepts that they're all considering, just so that they all know that they're talking about the same aspect or the same phenomenon.
Yeah, but could we call those formulas, in other words? In other words, the process requires them to conceive this in the aspect of a formula.
Well, the formula makes it more visible, you might say, but actually what's really being talked about are the concepts represented by the formula, and some of them are not so easy to understand. Mm-hmm. Now, when you get into, for instance, the subject of dielectricity and all of these aspects of the more ethereal elements associated with electricity, you'll find that it's not so easy to even find so-called formulas that deal with it. I mean, you have formulas in specific instances, like I said earlier about, you know, the effects associated with the capacitor and displacement current, for instance. You can look that up. But when you start talking about, you know, the distributed capacity of a system and how you can maximize, you know, the flow of a dielectric current in a longitudinal displacement along the axis of a large coil, for instance, all that stuff would have to be derived, verified by experimentation, before you would even have the ability to do a healthy conversation on the subject. And there are a couple of people that I know of alive today who know a whole lot more about that stuff than I do. I don't know that it would be a good idea to mention their names, but they're both friends of mine, and you know, they've been doing this work just like I've been doing the things I've been focused on for many, many years. And I might add that their lives have been made absolutely miserable, and the progress that they could have enjoyed has been stymied by the establishment, because nobody mm-hmm. wants this stuff. I mean, that's very, very evident.
It poses a threat to the system as the system is operating right now, is what you're saying. Or are you saying?
Oh, sure, because even though Tesla was the one who essentially gave birth to the electrical system that's in use today, and by that I mean the polyphase AC transmission system that includes generators, transformers, transmission lines, and motors. In later years, he totally eclipsed the performance of his own discoveries with newer discoveries. And that was the reason why Morgan put up such a stink about the whole thing. He said, well, you know, we're reaping the benefits of your first set of inventions here. We've got hundreds of millions of dollars invested in the grid that we've put together all over the nation, and we're doing just fine financially. We don't want you to come along and obsolete all of this with another set of inventions just because they work in a different way and produce a more efficient results. Who wants to be bothered with that? And so, you know, as he persisted to try and explain the benefits of what he was doing, they just responded by putting him out of business.
Yeah. Do you suspect or have you seen any evidence that that those ideas have been put to use in some way?
I can tell you stories that demonstrate very succinctly that, and I don't know who, so I'm not going to use the word government because I don't even know if it's the government or not, but let's just say some part of the establishment has made use of this stuff for their own ends while simultaneously depriving the rest of us from using it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
can you give examples of where that is?
Pardon me?
Can you give us some examples of where that is or might be?
I can give you examples of it, but I'm not going to specifically relate the instances in which this was discovered because I'd be putting some people in jeopardy.
Okay.
But, what you can definitely rest assured of is the fact that it's been used primarily in the communications industry and also in the generation of electrical power.
Okay.
As far as the communications situation is concerned, Tesla had talked about communication systems which would operate globally without the use of radio waves. And you have to understand that he looked upon the radio wave or the Hertzian concept of communication as being the most primitive and exceptionally inefficient method imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And so by his very nature, even though he worked with it, and started
yeah.
with, he still abhorred it in the end and went to this other form of communication which used the earth as a conductor. And we've talked about that before.
Yes.
And once you learn how to do that, now the earth itself can either be a conductor used for the transmission of power or it can be used for communication purposes. Or both simultaneously. And the interesting thing is certain individuals who thought they were doing pioneering work in this area, when they perfected their apparatus, were surprised to find that there's all kinds of communication going on in the non-radio world already. And you and I both know that when Tesla was murdered, his safe was rifled,
yeah.
and only God knows what information was taken out of there and where it went. But that's already, 60-some-odd years ago? 65 years ago, something like that?
67 years.
Okay,
67 years ago.
And so there's been plenty of time for people that had plenty of money to put those concepts to work for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm. Do you think or do you suspect that that's being used anyway in any sort of transportation, say in interstellar transportation or space exploration, anything like that?
Well, I can tell you this much. Tesla and a bunch of other people besides him, Schoberger, for instance, was another guy, demonstrated to their satisfaction that there's a relationship between gravity and electricity. And I would suspect that if these basic principles were exposed, that it's only a question of time and money before you could have a propulsion system that worked on that basis. Otis T. Carr was trying to do that in the 1950s, for God's sake, and he was using information given to him by Tesla.
Yes.
And he was just a poor schlep who was interested in doing it. He didn't really have any qualifications from a standpoint of a scientist. I met the guy. I know what he was like. But now take and imagine that same information being attacked by handfuls of highly trained, highly motivated, highly paid physicists in some obscure location, and I don't see why you wouldn't come up with all kinds of things that nobody else can envision.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we're in school, we're always, you were probably posed the same question. I know I was, and many of the listeners probably were, this question of if a tree fell in the forest and there was no one there to hear it, would there be sound? Well, that's, we could ask the same question. If there was an electrical current moving through a wire and no one was there to witness it, would there be electricity? You know, maybe that's not the best metaphor or best example, but in other words, this, because we don't see this energy in the grid, because we're not aware of it, at least, consciously, we might be very aware of it subconsciously. It might be part of what keeps us alive on some level. And that mixed with the alchemy of the metabolistic process in the body, and breathing, which is again part of that same system, breathing air and interacting with those things that affect us physically and mentally and spiritually, that on some level maybe we are responding to the grid the same way a component in an integrated circuit responds when it's hooked into the whole grid. You get my meaning?
Yeah, I get your meaning. I think that the concept of the grid and everything associated with it is such a small part of the overall picture that mm-hmm. to focus on it, it might be misleading. I think that if you stop and consider the fact that anybody that has ever really given a great deal of thought to the way in which all this stuff fits together has concluded that they're all interrelated. Einstein spent the last part of his life trying to discover the so-called unified field theorem that would allow him to tie all these various forces together, you know, in some coherent fashion. He never found it. I don't think that anybody else has found it, or at least if they have, they certainly haven't published it. But I think that the reason why people are stymied when it comes to this stuff is because the way in which they're educated focuses them on such a small portion of the overall picture that they come to incorrect conclusions. Take gravity, for instance. I think that if you set up a laboratory looking for the so-called graviton particle, that you're going to spend an enormous amount of money and an unbelievable amount of time looking for something which may not exist. The proper thing to do is to look at the whole planet as a piece of machinery that was invented by a really brilliant mind and say, okay, why does that planet have a gravitational field? And I think once you start to look at it from a proper perspective,
mm-hmm.
you wind up getting different answers. Because look at it this way. If we leave the planet Earth and we go out there far enough, you'll agree that if we're looking at it through a telescope or something, we can get far enough away that it can be perceived as an infinitesimally small speck. And once you do that, how is it different from an electron? How is it different from an atom? The only difference is perspective.
Yeah.
You know, all of these things have certain functionalities and fit into the scheme of nature in a way that is divided by octaves of reality. And those octaves exist whether you perceive them or not.
Yes, there is sound in the forest, even when no one's there to hear it.
I'm sure there is.
You know, and there is this energy that exists that can be harnessed and transmuted into electricity. See, what I'm getting at here is we have become dependent on oil being that which produces electricity, or coal, which is that which produces electricity. You know, who's shoveling the coal and pumping the oil that creates the lightning bolts? You know, if you get my meaning, it's that energy is able to manifest itself in a form of current and interact with the environment, the atmosphere, the earth itself, and the things that are on the surface of the earth. When it strikes a tree, it can knock a limb off, or it can do nothing. Some people have been killed by being struck by a lightning bolt. Others become more intelligent or more conscious. Everything reacts differently to it. So there are a variety of possibilities, endless possibilities that can occur with this. So there must be.
I can tell you an interesting little anecdote that happened to me personally, which might fill in a couple of gaps for you.
Okay.
Years ago, back in the 60s, before my dad passed away, he took the family on a summer vacation in which we went all around the United States. And I'm not going to mention any names here, but for a lot of reasons. But we wound up, in part of this journey, visiting a friend of my dad's who had a pretty sizable ranch. And at the time that we visited him, and we were there for about 2 weeks, it was really an amazing experience. But anyway, while we were there, there were a lot of other guests enjoying a stay at the same place, and two of them were astronauts. They were there with their wives. And needless to say, because of my interest, I spoke at considerable length with these guys, most particularly with one of them. And I started talking to him about Tesla and some of these other guys that had been working on these unusual things, and asked him some questions about, you know, what he's taught and this and that and the other thing. And basically, he came back with a pretty standard answer at first. He said, well, you know, he said, what I know about those subjects, I wouldn't be allowed to tell you anyway, simply because of the fact that, you know, I'm still involved with the military and with NASA and with all these different organizations, and I've taken various oaths and signed various documents to preclude me from talking about proprietary subjects. He said, but I will tell you one thing that you might consider. And he said, did you ever wonder why they don't use generators to produce electricity in rockets and satellites? And my first answer was, well, they're probably too heavy. Because, you know, they are. And he said, well, he said, that certainly enters into it. And he said, but that's not the reason. And he said, the reason is because generators, especially generators that are powered by permanent magnets, cease to function when they get high enough above the Earth. They just stop working. And so I pondered on that for many, many years. And the interesting thing is that if you go back and look at Wilhelm Reich's work, you'll find that he defines this orgone envelope around the Earth as being a very, very narrow band, which is reasonably close to the Earth's surface. And in fact, it coincides with the so-called biosphere. Now, if the orgone or the ether or massless charge is in fact in that area, doesn't it stand to reason that there is a coupling between that form of energy and electromagnetics that occur in these generating devices?
Yeah.
Which may be completely ignored by science, but which suddenly waves a red flag if you elevate a piece of electrical generation equipment to an altitude that is above this so-called orgone envelope. Now, I have no proof of this, but that would be my suspicion based on what this particular astronaut said to me when I was a lot younger.
I'm wondering if there's not a point where, where the generator stops working, that it stops working because it's not necessary to have one at that point. Yet, it doesn't accomplish the goal of why, you know, what the rocket has to do to propel whatever it's propelling as its payload to its destination.
Well, I'm sure that enters into it, but I think the real lesson to learn from this is everybody's running around like a bunch of panic-stricken chickens trying to find so-called free energy. And I think that what we're really hearing here is that the very elusive thing that everybody's looking for is not only already here, but it's already part of our electrical system. It's just that the way in which we are making use of it with these primitive generation devices forces us to pay for it through the nose. But I mean, it can be demonstrated, for instance, just with the analysis of pointing vector, for instance, that there is something entering the electrical conductors in a generating device from the outside coming in. And if you do a similar analysis on the motor, for instance, that something is being released at the other end. Now, the fact that you have to pay a price to make that happen may very well be a consequence of the design and the geometry and the limited understanding that we have of this process. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to remain that way.
This is, you know, I got a message from one of our listeners. He mentions Nassim Haramein found this in fractals. And I think what he's implying, I guess, found this. I don't know what word John means, John in Massachusetts. Hi, John. I think what he's trying to say is that there are these phenomenon that occur which are maybe in part random or maybe even very disorganized in a sense. I don't know if I would call it chaotic, but disorganized, no general pattern, but still would allow maybe crystals to grow or create turbulence in fluids, or maybe even play a part in how the whole galaxy is tied together. He mentions fractals. That's why I described that. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but.
Well, see, fractals are an interesting subset of reality. But I think, and I'm not saying there's no connection there, but what I am going to say is that there's a subject called complexity theory, which it actually makes this very type of thing more palatable, might be the right word. Because what we're talking about here is a situation where you're playing games, and that's literally what you're doing. You're playing games with the boundary of a particular system. And on one side of that boundary, you have chaos, and on the other side, you have an organized equilibrium. Now, the tendency has always been that you recognize the boundary and you work on the side of it that has the organized equilibrium with the full realization that on the other side you have nothing but chaos. Complexity theory suggests that if you oscillate or vacillate, whatever term you want to use, alternate between systems that have chaos and systems that have order, and you do this in a way that has predictable periodicity, then what happens is very interesting, because you get into a situation where if you're organizing this chaotic environment to the point where it establishes an equilibrium, even momentarily, before it returns to the other state, You now are in a position where, first of all, you're forced to use information to accomplish this. And secondly, the so-called random aspect of that chaos is being organized into something that you can make use of. Now what happens is you enter into a situation where you've got negentropy. In other words, the system becomes self-organizing to an extent.
Yeah.
And, you know, now you've got something which flies in the face of normal reasoning when it comes to the subject of entropy.
Yeah, that just raises a whole bunch of questions that we would go on for many more hours. But I understand what you're saying, and I think you did an excellent job explaining that.
Well, I wish that there was a way to, to be more succinct when it comes to this stuff. But, you know, we're bordering on areas in which I have limited understanding to begin with, even though I've spent a lot of years playing with this stuff. The real trick is, to learn enough about it to be able to have totally predictable results, which are repeatable. And that's not always the case. I know a lot of people who have entered into this region, and every once in a while they'll get a fantastic result, but they can never seem to get back to it. Or if they do, it's at an unexpected time. And so that gives organized science a way out of the situation, because they can just say, well, your experiments are flawed, or you're dealing with something that's anomalous, or that's the most plausible thing to say would be that, if you can't nail it down, you can't prove it exists. You know, that's why in troubleshooting, you always look for something that's repetitive, so that you can identify what's happening. If you have a sporadic result every 2-3 months, it's pretty hard to figure it out.
Yeah. While you were describing fractals, I had a flash, and this might resonate with you. If if we were to able to understand these processes that you just described, or these conditions and what manifests from those conditions, you know, cause and effect, if we were to understand that in a scientific manner, it would open up a gateway to consciousness at the same time on a parallel scale.
Oh, well, you know what? I think you just hit on something. Maybe you don't even realize what you just said. But
I know what I just said, but I want your response.
Well, I'm going to give you the response. Consciousness is fractal. What that really means is, you know, it's like saying, okay, we're approaching the planet and we're going to look at a particular coastline. And so, okay, you see this squiggly line with all the little indentations and whatever you want to call it. And then as you approach down further, those little squiggly lines and stuff like that that define harbors and inlets and estuaries and what have you, and you find out that they have squiggly little lines and coastlines and all that kind of stuff. And you can continue that process right down to the molecular level. And so, you know, what that's saying about reality is, not only is the reality built that way, but if you perceive it as such, then you're operating, your consciousness is operating in a fractal manner also. And that's exactly what we've been trying to say for months, is that, you know, you can open up your consciousness to any level that you choose just by altering your perspective. You know, who can tell you what you're perceiving? I mean, it's all right if you want to perceive what everybody else perceives, but there's nothing from stopping you from going further.
Yes.
How do you look at it?
Yeah. Now, I got another response, if I can read this quickly to you. This is, again, from John in Massachusetts. He calls attention to the fact that you mentioned the unified field theory. And he goes on to say in one sentence here, fractals can illustrate infinity in both ways, including nasty infinity, he says. You want to comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure what he means by nasty infinity, but I'll certainly go along with
Let's say the negative or the dark or the demonic, maybe. Maybe he's looking
at it. Well, I was going to say, I certainly go along with the fact that a fractal reality is also polarized. Because,
yes,
for instance, at the one end, you have gross matter, huge things that are following the laws of fractal organization. And at the opposite end, you're down in the subatomic area, and you're still dealing with the exact same laws, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who wrote, I can't think of his name right now, it begins with an M. But anyway, he wrote some really amazing books on fractals, and I believe he was given some rewards and such for his work. But, you know, they have programs now which develop various fractal geometries, and you can literally program them and tell them, you know, what level of this fractal environment you want to look at or you want to investigate. And the interesting thing is there are features that change, but even though they're changed, they're the same. And that's the whole thing about fractals. You know, it's the same thing over and over again on different levels. And when you move to a different perspective, all of those little nuances associated with each of those levels of reality combine to give you the next level. It's really a bizarre but fascinating thing.
Well, that's why people who are, let's say, a student of metaphysics places some value in a certain type of a quartz crystal, for example, in that the crystal is interacting in this field in a fractal way, and at the same time, if the person who is observing the crystal or connecting with the crystal on some other level is able to then tap into that information or into that field, regardless of the type of field that it is. I think being able to do that and be conscious of it would cause an increase in consciousness. In other words, there would be a complete exchange of information, not partial, or at least as much as a person could handle.
Yeah, I think that's the key to the whole thing right there, because the mind is a fascinating thing, but we can't lose sight of the fact that we are conditioned by this artificial environment in such a way that the minds of most people are only capable of accepting a certain amount of information before the tilt sign comes on or the overload signal comes on or whatever you want to call it. And that doesn't mean that the mind itself is incapable of dealing with it. It just means that you have certain programmed limits which you are very conscious of, even if it's only on a subconscious level. And when you approach those limits, you start to get a really, really uncomfortable feeling until finally, you know, it reaches a saturation point and you just say, I can't go anywhere with this. I can't go any further with this.
Yeah.
But that's an imposed restriction, you understand.
I tend to think that we already have all that information. It's just that we are not able to access it, whether it's physiologically or psychologically or even metaphysically, if you understand what I'm saying. It may be that it's all there already. If it exists everywhere, why wouldn't it be there?
Yeah, of course. But you see, this is the age-old argument about the difference between retaining what you perceive as your identity or your ego, or letting go of that and becoming part of a greater consciousness. When you let go and you become part of the greater consciousness, all that's available to you. But as long as you insist on being John Doe, then the only thing you're going to know is what John Doe has been allowed to learn.
And yeah, it difference. Begs the question. You wonder if one could harness that their consciousness, would it be enough to even light up an LED? You know, a light emitting diode.
Are you talking about the average everyday consciousness or the
totality? Yeah, I'm saying the average consciousness. Yeah.
Oh, I think you'd be very disappointed. I think you're right. It would just be a little below somewhere. Because that's all we've been permitted to become, is harmless little glows. The people who aspire to become 1,000-watt bulbs are looked upon with great disdain and carefully watched.
Mm-hmm. We could say that's all we've been allowed to become, because
that's
inherently most beings have the desire to experience that level of consciousness, totally, you know?
Well, they have the desire, but you hit the nail on the head, and I did say it also, that that's all we're allowed to become. And that's what the rebellion should really be about. Who are these people who have the gall to tell me what my limits are?
Mm-hmm. And you could channel that.
And most of them are dunderheads to begin with.
Yeah, you could channel that into any social concept, you know, patriotism or in terms of what your life's purpose is, your calling, your passion, be it science or one of the arts. Let's just use that for example. You know, something as simple as a farmer is actually a very complex field to be in, to be skilled at it. You know, there's a lot more to it than tilling the soil, watering the soil, planting a few seeds, maybe throwing some fertilizer on it or pesticides. You know, there's so much more. What could we do with nature in a proper sense if we knew more about how we're violating the laws of nature?
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, what is a farmer nowadays? A farmer is taught what fertilizers to use, and not only is he taught what fertilizers to use, but that's all that's available to him anyway. Now, you go through a certain regimented procedure that winds up producing a crop, and as long as you've got a heavy investment in that, you're doing something useful, and you're allowed to proceed in that vein until you run out of steam and die. And so you're trapped. You're trapped by the way the establishment has limited you, and you're trapped by the selection you have made. Now look at Scotland and remember the community of Finhorn. The Finhorn, they were playing around with very primitive information that they received by doing their own research, by combining alchemy and other information about the soil and about the atmosphere. And they were growing cabbages and stuff like that and melons and all sorts of things that were like five times the average size that you get with this fertilizer that we use over here. And there was no artificial anything involved in it. And they were going like gangbusters for a long time. I don't know if they still exist or not, but I wouldn't be surprised if they got snuffed out because of what they were doing. Anytime that you do something which shows great promise for the benefit of mankind and goes against the grain of the system, something unpleasant happens to you.
Yeah, I think, we're out of time, but it was a very interesting discussion. And see, we started off with electricity, and look where we ended. We come back again to addressing the issue of who we really are and why are we here. You know,
well,
the meaning
of life.
Well, I think
that's a fundamental undercurrent that's associated with any human endeavor imaginable. It always brings you to that point.
Yes. Well, Jim, it's been a very interesting discussion. I'm sure you had much more to share with us, and I hope I didn't cause you to feel like I was pulling you off track or something. I was trying to evoke some material from you, some information from you that's different from what you hear from everybody else, or you don't hear at all.
Get it?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, well, did you get it?
I did, and I can see John in Massachusetts did too. In fact, he was being a little bit cryptic in what he conveyed to us, but he said we picked up on it, so what he was trying to say.
Well, the point is that even the way in which we utilize and absorb information is fractal. I mean, you can go as far as you want in any subject and become the greatest expert in that field as you choose to be. The frustrating part is there is always more. Always.
Yes.
And so, that's the nature of all of reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, I enjoyed our discussion this evening. I hope you did, too. And I look forward to you coming back next Friday.
Well, I'll make a special effort to be here as usual.
Okay. All right. Well, you have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next Friday. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. And our special guest tonight, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim will be back with us next week, same time, same place. We'd also like to thank Wind Talkers Radio Network for tuning in. over at BBS Radio, Don Newsom on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in this evening. Join us next week, next Monday, when my guest will be Dr. A. Drew Ott. In the meantime, I wish you a great weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.